Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we've got Paul with us. And we just dove into the Second Amendment rights, or, you know, the right to bear arms, or more aptly stated, the responsibility to bear arms. So what we just did was before we had to run to break and cut yesterday's episode, we had covered the Bill of, or I should say the Second Amendment out of the Bill of Rights. So let's do this. Go ahead and read this one short line, and then we can actually start diving into this very specifically, because this really does deserve a deep dive. It really does deserve that. So let's go ahead.
Okay, so we're going to read the Second Amendment. Here we go.
All right.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Okay, so the prelude, it's almost like a preamble to the reason why people must have guns. And actually, weaponry is for the security of a free state. It has nothing to do with hunting. It has nothing to do with just basic self-defense. It has everything to do to be a military state. Mm-hmm. I want to be very clear here. The power that a individual citizen of the United States should bear is the level of type of, I'll say, force and or weaponry that's capable of dealing with the current governmental threat, from external or internal governmental threat. And because the whole point was that our national defense depended upon the militia. The army itself didn't exist until the militia was federalized. And so the only reason to keep an army would have been just not an army, but an office of the Department of War, was because there you had to have at least a little bit of bureaucracy to make sure that the states were actually always prepared.
Correct.
And so, because nobody can underestimate, or easily everybody can underestimate the real threats against America. But we're actualizing today that the real threats against America is not only worldwide, it is absolutely right here in Main Street USA, because it is our government that is actually actively taking away our rights. And which is why every state in the union has a militia law, or at least by the Constitution, they all have to be able to respond with a militia. Now, here's the interesting thing. Alaska and Canada came into the Union very late in the 1900s. They may be two states that have not been directed, like all the other 48 states, to actually have militias, which would
Did you mean Alaska and Hawaii?
Correct.
You said Alaska and Canada.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. My mind is on a lot of different things right now, so as you know.
Okay.
And so anyway, you're right. Alaska and Hawaii came into the Union in the 40s, 50s time frame.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And so when they came into the Union, I question whether, because by this point in time, the progressive movement had advanced so far that they had completely, because by 1903, the Dick Act really reconfigured the militia. And I believe they used the Dick Act to actually justify the non-configuration, the non-constitutional configuration of the militias in both Alaska as well as Canada. Or not Canada.
Hawaii.
Hawaii, thank you.
Hawaii, right.
I caught myself that time. Okay. So, you know, you got to get to go through Canada to get to Alaska. At least that's how I did when we were kids. Because we actually did a drive up. But anywho, nevertheless, the law demands that every citizen, this is the constitutional law, every citizen be prepared to execute the laws of the Union to suppress insurrections and to repel invasions. That is the national defense. That's the script right there in the Constitution that has never, capital N to E V E R, all caps, never been amended to give the federal government a mechanism to do something different.
Right. And you're quoting Article 1, Section 8, Clause 14.
Correct.
You know, to provide for calling for the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
That is correct. So when you look at the oath of a citizen, so all citizens that have been naturalized, that have come here from the very beginning to today, they have all had to raise their arm to join in the citizen's responsibility. I got to emphasize this. Every citizen has the responsibility to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Anybody that's being naturalized is basically sworn that they will take up arms to defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies, foreign and domestic. Therefore, and that's the same oath that is implied upon or actually given to military and so, law enforcement and so forth. And folks, I'm here to tell you that that's equally applicable by birthright. Equally applicable because the states have laws to compel you. Whether you like it, I mean, they feminized us through diet and as, you know, evidence is starting to point towards heavy metals and such, they have been poisoning us to basically become more and more pacifist. As a matter of fact, people have probably seen the Bill Gates video where he talks about using vaccines to basically reprogram people to be less religious and which would mean would possibly be less patriotic. It's all about engineering, especially to somebody that believes in software engineering and hardware engineering, such as Bill Gates and the rest of the globalists. They're doing everything they can to biologically engineer a better society. And
they consider it to be a better society. Right,
right, right, right. And going down the same path, they're actually trying to get rid of a lot of the bodies because they don't need so much.
Mm. So, GR, while you were speaking, I looked up the oath of a citizen, and there's something here. If you don't mind, I'm going to
go ahead. Let's dive into it.
It says that I will bear arms on behalf of the United States when required by law, or that I will perform non-combatant service in the armed forces of the United States when required by law.
Right.
Yep. That I'll perform work of national importance under civilian direction when required by law. This is from within the oath of the citizen.
Yep.
And this isn't taught in – I mean, I didn't even learn this in school. They did teach way back when, you know, the Constitution, which they're not doing now.
Right.
But I didn't even learn this part in school,
right,
that they were expected to bear arms when required by law, mm-hmm, to defend the Constitution, and still are. This oath is still current.
Yes. And they don't want to play around with those types of things because they don't want to tip their hands. Period.
Okay.
Period. They don't want to tip their hands. But let me rant a lot more about this.
Okay.
So when we really look at, you know, the state's responsibility in maintaining the militia and how the states had basically, I don't want to say turned their backs, but the federal government came along with some money to reconfigure the militia, and the states willingly took that money so that they could, you know, get some jobs and, you know, seem like they're the good guys, you know, getting some money into the state coffers. And so, we're so happy that you did this. And what they ended up doing was they ended up restructuring where the militia was no longer configured by county, where there now are counties that have zero representation in the state structure, that what they call the militia, the National Guard and National Air Guard. And if you really look at, you know, the membership, you'll probably find that in several states, the membership of those militias, there are several, or I should say, the National Guard system, that there's probably several counties that have zero representation, where the whole design of the militia was to be apportioned by the population of the county. That was well discussed. We went through this in the ratification debates. Because George Mason was talking about the structure of the militia and how they were going to dismember it. And they did, but the whole point wasn't that, you know, they were going to do it constitutionally. The whole point Madison pointed out is they can't do it unless they violate the Constitution.
Or change the Constitution, which they didn't
do. Which they didn't do. Correct. Correct. They didn't change the Constitution. So let's peel the onion a little bit further. This is where we're probably, I will probably get a lot of hate mail from some people that are stuck in a paradigm. Now, let's look at, let's look at reality. Every person should have, and we should actually seek to make sure that everybody who's capable of bearing the responsibility bear that responsibility. Now, this, to me, this is almost double speak of a politician when they start using this type of wording. So this is why I really need to dive into this.
Okay.
And so we have to acknowledge that there are people today that are not fit to hold a weapon. We see this time and time again, that the leftists, the way they have programmed these people, they are not stable. They do not look at the honor and the integrity of being a U.S. citizen. They have actually, our education system has weaponized the minds of our children to become revolutionaries, to do whatever is necessary to obtain their means, whether that's going to school and shooting up their fellow kids, whatever it takes, the ends justify the means. And so we're not being genuine and we're not being honest if we all come to the table and say every kid out there needs to have a weapon in their hands when they turn 18. Because I'm here to tell you that many of those kids should not hold a weapon. Many of those kids need to actually be tested and verified. And so our future is in grave danger. But we have to empower the states and we have to empower the citizenry to be able to come up with their measures of what they think is best. And this is the beauty of the divine hand of providence, because that mechanism in determining, you know, what, who, and how he should, you know, have the responsibility of defending this nation, repelling invasions and suppressing insurrections and executing the laws, that should go to your county government and to the county representatives and actually ultimately to the people. We, the people at the county level, need to actually start differentiating and determining what kids should actually be able to defend the Constitution, because it shouldn't be everybody, folks. I'm telling you, it's a lot of these kids, they're so screwed up because of the education system that, and it's our fault for letting this get this way. But we cannot just stand up and say, put guns in everybody's hands. And I'll tell you, the gun lobbyists don't want to hear that. And I'll be vilified because this podcast will probably be out there where people will be hearing me say that not everybody should have guns in their hands. Mm-hmm. But let's place context to this. We actually have to come up with methods, and we need smart people, and we need everybody at the table to have this conversation. Our school system has been so successful in weaponizing our own children, and we have been completely blinded by this. Over the past several decades, it started in the 80s. And so, because.
It may have been before that, but go ahead, because I think your point's clear.
It started in the 80s because the homosexual movement, it started mid-70s. When the homosexual movement started driving into, I will say, the entertainment industry with Three's Company and, you know, rest in peace, Suzanne Summers, for being one of the people to help, you know, do-si-do homosexuality into the living room and the family rooms of every American household. You know, in the 70s, you know, she was really a pioneer, wasn't she? And so they began actually playing with this homosexual agenda. And next thing you know, GLAAD came along and started literally driving this agenda within schools, or not within schools, within every program. By the time it was in the 90s, even Seinfeld had to do a show basically to address homosexuality, not that there's anything wrong with it, if you remember that episode. But most of the time, they didn't delve in that at all. It was only, I think, in the one episode, maybe two, where the GLAAD basically pressured them to say, you have not done anything favorable for homosexuals. And GLAAD has become a huge driver of content that has been fed into, you know, all of these different mediums. They go after everybody. And so the fact of the matter is I believe that we saw the beginning of the plan being executed in the 70s, but I think that it really started taking root because the discussion, it only took 10 years for the discussion to finally be on the lips of politicians about homosexual marriage. Mm-hmm. And so, folks, I mean, when they started literally attacking the nucleus of our society, the family, that, I mean, when you really look at the plan or the playbook, W. Cleon Skousen in The Naked Communist lays out these 45 goals, and normalizing homosexuality was one of them. And so,
I've read that.
And so, you know, we have to be either disingenuous, or we have to be, you know, I'll just say brain dead, not to actually have this honest conversation that over the past several decades, because we have failed to demand full compliance of the Constitution because we just didn't understand what the heck was going on. It wasn't until, the awakening for me was the ratification debates, and it wasn't until we had access to these documents to where we could actually start making sense of everything, of what we needed to do.
So do you mind if I add some context to what you were saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things you mentioned was that we kind of transitioned to there are some kids but that we can't put guns in the hands of. But let me help with that transition, because going back to Article 1, Section 8, the next clause after what Congress has a responsibility to call for the militia is this one. It says to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So the reason I want to bring this up for context is because we made this transition without specifying that the Constitution gives Congress the authority. You know what that means? It means that we can spend money. This is something Congress can spend money to do. Spend money from the public treasury to put arms in the hands of citizens and then teach them how to use them. And a lot of people who don't understand, but quote the Second Amendment as the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, don't forget or don't see the big picture that the militia is literally constitutional homeland security.
Well, so let me add to that. Not only Homeland Security, but when you look at the text, actually, I'm really glad you did this, man, because when you look at the text right there of 15, organizing, arming, and disciplining. And so, in other words, going down to this organizing and arming is not just equipping, but helping them be trained and prepared. And so when we look at, because inside this whole thing, and the authority of training the militia according to this discipline prescribed by Congress. So in other words, Congress has a responsibility. The one responsibility in education at all within this Constitution, it demands that they actually prepare our children to defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic.
And to teach them to use arms to do so.
Yeah, weapon safety, tactics, the basic stuff that we need to be able to actually do this one thing in the Second Amendment. And this one thing is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
Okay. Therefore, so what that means is, putting in context, that's why the county, as you suggest, must determine what youth may be fit to bear arms and which youth may not, especially in today's society.
Yes. Yes. And as a matter of fact, I think it would be very easy. I think, and this is where all of a sudden even more deception gets played. That, you know, anybody that's a progressive will actually have to, you know, put their, you know, quasi, I'll just say, facade, you know, make this persona that they're actually conservative and that they, you know, they want to, they're constitutional. No. We actually have to have, and we actually have to have some very good standards of testing and understanding the Constitution. And I believe that if we don't do that, then we need to, at a minimum, ensure that we don't put guns in everybody's hands. That the best way to, you know, kind of subdue the spirit of these evil guided children is to put them into service roles where they don't hold a gun, maybe on the administration, so that then they start learning what they really need to know and why they're learning that. Because the only way you can actually deprogram, or I should say educate somebody outside of how they've been educated, is by giving them the truth. Because when it comes down to it, you know, I know that there's lots of people out there that are really steeped in their biases, but when it comes down to the truth, because I've met people, regardless of whether it's a racial bias, whether it is a religious bias, or whether it is a, let's just say, you know, scientific bias or a musical bias, when it really comes down to what the truth is and the person cannot refute the truth, guess what? Well, you've literally shattered their bubble. You've literally broken through their paradigm, and their paradigm can't hold water anymore. Right. Now, the person that clings to that broken paradigm is, I will say, is likely one of those people that really need monitoring. Do we have, you know, mental ill problems? Absolutely we do. And as a matter of fact, you know, we as a society have really failed. So this is where I want to go down this path where I'm not saying we have to take and keep guns out of the hands of the people. We have to have a very cognizant, we're going into break, we have to have a very cognizant, you know, perception on what we're supposed to do. And so when we come back from the break, I want to dive into what we really need to do to overcome the damage done by the progressives who have had unfettered access to our children for decades, going all the way back to the 50s. But anyway, We'll be right back after this, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so the framers missed something here because they really didn't understand that the government of the United States would become so antithetical to the Constitution, so diametrically opposed to the protections that are within baked within this Constitution. I mean, they couldn't fathom this. Mm-hmm. And so we're now at a point where we have had, you know, decades of programming, different degrees of people that are just not suitable to be U.S. citizens. And so in tandem to this right to bear arms, I'm telling you that if a person is not capable of supporting and defending the Constitution, they do not deserve the right to vote.
That's pretty strong. You think before you were going to get hate mail.
But let's think about this, because anybody, and this goes down this path, because I've had this conversation with you and other people, that this whole concept of the right of privacy to vote is literally the devil's playground, because bottom line, the devil thrives in dark secrecy. And so when we have politicians who have openly hoodwinked and said, you vote for me, I'm going to give you health care. You vote for me, I'm going to put a chicken in your pot.
And so what's the history of this?
The history goes all the way back to where, you know, people have started voting for politicians to give them things when the Constitution clearly does not authorize them to do this. In other words, what's happening is we've got politicians that are buying votes by using the public purse. And they're violating not only the public purse, but they're violating the essence of the Constitution, exercising powers they don't have. And so when a person uses their vote to undermine the Constitution, you've already created a weapon to actually attack the Constitution, because I'm willing to vote for anybody that's going to do whatever's necessary in violating the Constitution to get us to where we need to go. We don't care about amendments. We just need to get our people in there so that they can compromise our way into subjugation, into slavery.
But you mentioned the privacy of the vote, and I was just wondering, what's the history behind that? What you're saying is that, you know,
so if you really look at how voting was done in the old days, and as a matter of fact, mm-hmm. you could go back to Landslide Lyndon when they actually registered who came in to vote and how they voted, as well as, you know, the order. So in other words, the way they used to make the polls and the secrecy to vote, if you do the research on this, it didn't really start existing until all of a sudden people wanted to actually start doing evil things with government. In other words, giving the power to our politicians to compromise and violate the Constitution. So this really started happening in the late 1800s. in the late 1800s, it, you know, the desire to not have people know how you voted because they, you know, and in some ways you could have had a real good, and this supported the desire for secrecy, because in some areas, like in the South, where, you know, I'll just say racial discrimination was really, you know, we want to keep the blacks in place, keep them in check. And so it was those people who in secret said, you know, I don't support that. Vote for me so I can actually, you know, help liberate the blacks, which were the Republicans in doing that. And so you started actually finding that by party, there was this unstated association that the Republicans were in support of liberty for the blacks and the Democrats were in support of, you know, maintaining oppressive laws and keeping the blacks under control. Does that make sense?
But what you're suggesting is that votes cast weren't secret previously.
They weren't. That's so if you look at the 1700s, in the late 1700s, when George Washington was elected, everybody, you know, they voted for their elector. And when you went to vote, how did you vote? They didn't have the Dominion machines in 1789 when they elected, or 1788 when I believe the federal elections went, I think, either in the December, November timeframe and or into February, depending. I don't know if they, you know, when the federal election was, but it was somewhere in the wintertime. And so when they executed the election, that was done at the county level, and you went to the sheriff, and the sheriff basically, you know, held this, and who did they vote for? Held this federal election, and they voted for an elector, and they voted for a representative, and that was it. There were no referendums, and there may have been some state issues, but they didn't have state issues back then. It was really just voting for representation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, however, it was, and I think in Madison's case, there were only two people that were running for that seat. It was Monroe and Madison. And if I remember correctly, in the Monroe and Madison case on the election days, because it was several counties, many of the counties, it was just an open election by a raise of hand. The sheriff would actually assemble everybody, be here at this point in time. Maybe some sheriffs actually had it written down in a book that so-and-so came by. They paid their poll tax. They had to pay a poll tax, by the way. They paid their poll tax, and they cast their vote for Monroe, and they casted their vote for this elector who was going to vote a particular way. And so they basically did the election in one day. Then the sheriff took that data and had that data transmitted to the state capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And the state capitol basically tallied the votes. It wasn't a dark secret where you went behind a booth and voted in secret. There was no secrecy back then. The right to vote shall not be infringed. And I'm here to tell you that back in those days, people were very proud of how they voted. The fact of creating secrecy only started coming forward out of the desire of the, or I should say, once the nation became more diametrically opposed, then all of a sudden secrecy started becoming a desire by both sides. And when we started looking at the evil and fighting the evil in entrenched areas like in the South, and or the evil in going into entrenched areas of the conservative of the North, in getting bad people in and people that were going to have agendas, because I believe you'll find the secrecy. I've never done the research on this, but I do know that a lot of times the sheriff had the discretion of how to vote. The state legislatures basically said, you'll have this election on this day, and they left it to the best judgment of the sheriff.
Huh?
They left it to the best judgment of the sheriff. The only thing that they may have regulated was, you know, the qualifications and those types of things. In the early days of the 1800s, they didn't regulate it to the ad nauseum that we have regulations today. Show me where any regulation and or law required secrecy in the 1800s, or I should say in the 1700s, and the same thing when it got to the 1800s. They had open elections. So when did we actually start having secret elections? It's worth doing the dive in, but this isn't about elections. This is about the Second Amendment. And so when we get to the elections and we look at how all of a sudden the federal government started getting involved in elections, that's about the time when you can see the secrecy already playing out. Mm-hmm. And that was when? When was the first amendment regarding voting?
That was, I think, women's suffrage. No, it wasn't. It was the... it was the 13th Amendment.
No, right? It wasn't. It wasn't the 13th Amendment.
Okay.
It was proposed in 1869, and it was the right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. In other words, the right to vote was finally extended in an amendment to blacks.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Okay.
They created the amendment to allow them to vote because prior to that, I believe it was Taney that made the ruling that blacks couldn't vote in the Dred Scott case when Taney overturned the freedom of Dred Scott. In that Missouri Dred Scott case, then we actually see Taney actually reach in and say, hey, because he was wrong on this. They actually proved him wrong that blacks couldn't vote. And because blacks can't vote, he can't be free. Because they couldn't be citizens. And so the 14th Amendment gave them citizenship. 14th. And supposedly it was the right of the citizen to be able to vote, and apportionment was based on citizenship.
15, right.
The 15th
Sorry,
Amendment.
Not 13.
Right, the 14th Amendment, correct. Okay, so anyway, back to the Second Amendment and back to the counties and so forth. I honestly think that because of the election integrity and everything else, and as we start really looking at, you know, all of the different problems, the counties are really going to have to pull up their britches and have some tough discussions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is what I believe, this is what I wanted to start off with coming back from the break. I believe that it is the impetus, the requirement that the counties have to establish is they have to have a mechanism to try to ensure all people that are U.S. citizens or should be U.S. citizens should actually be fully supporting the Constitution. In other words, if you can't support the Constitution and its processes, like the Article 5 process to make changes and to live by the enumerations in the Constitution, so forth and so on, then you should not be able to vote. And as a matter of fact, I believe that every citizen, and I'm going into the voting, but I believe every citizen should have to take a test. They should at least, before they can vote, they should at least state the oath of a citizen, that they at least acknowledge that as a citizen, you have these responsibilities to protect and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, as we look at, you know, how we start going through and filtering through this, we have two problems. We have one, the problem with the citizen, which is a base problem, and we have a responsibility to prepare every person, every inhabitant that lives here, that actually, you know, make transition them to become a citizen, or I should say a full partaker in their responsibility as a citizen in this republic. There's way too many kids that are not ready, they're not prepared, and they shouldn't be given a right to vote. And the 18th, or I should say not the 18th, the 26th Amendment was the amendment that gave the right to vote to 18-year-olds. And I look at that when I was a kid and thought that was great. But now I look at it and I go, you know, I actually voted poorly when I was 18 years old. I voted wrong. It wasn't until I actually turned 20, and actually it was after, I was 20 when I was in the Marine Corps, when I actually changed the way I voted. And so I think that there is this need for not rushing people into this responsibility, but I believe every citizen, once you turn of age and you're capable of defending the Constitution, you should be able to petition your government at a minimum,
right,
but not vote. I believe that voting is something that you requires a little bit of more experience instead of just theory. Of what, you know, you're just walking out of school and your whole life is based on theory and no facts. And I think that, you know, age 20, 21, somewhere in there, because that's what it was before. Every state basically determined that 21 was the age. And I go, you know what? I think that was a huge mistake. But back to the Second Amendment. The county actually has this responsibility of educating people and getting them as a part of the militia and preparing them, but not, you know, and going through the process of saying these kids right here are not ready to hold guns. And if they can't hold guns, if they can't use deadly force, there's no greater deadly force than a vote. Because voting for a person that will actually destroy the liberties of people is just as bad as killing somebody. That's how the framers looked at it. Because when you really look at treason, when you allow a politician to commit treason, when they're violating their oath of office and taking away the rights of conscience and so forth, I mean, they used to hang people for horse thieving. As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson, when he lost his facsimile and, you know, a couple of his chests as he was moving from the presidency back to Monticello, these two thieves basically stole his chest. And when they caught these guys, they hanged them for theft, a capital offense back in those days. They took crime seriously. And they didn't play when it came down to the properties. And remember, because I just recently read this to you folks, that Madison looked at property, the most precious property are your rights, your liberties. That if they steal your right, they have stolen your liberty.
They've stolen your property.
Yes, that's what I meant. They have stolen property. It's because Madison stated that it can be said that a person has rights in their property. It can equally be said that they have property in their rights. So when they steal your rights, they're stealing your property. It's the same thing. Right. So I think we do have a real educational curve to get through. And I think that there's lots of kids that have been misinformed because I have a right to bear arms because this means I can, you know, make the decision of whether I want to kill people or not. No, no, no. There's a huge responsibility that comes with this right, a huge responsibility. We cannot downplay this. We have to actually help everybody understand the importance and the magnitude of the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. that we become the body of enforcement.
When you say body of enforcement,
yes,
that almost leads to another idea, and I don't know if we have time to cover it right now. But
go ahead. We got 9 minutes. Go ahead.
People go into careers of law enforcement.
Uh huh.
Okay. So are you suggesting that an enforcement of the laws probably needs to be different than what we're experiencing today?
Yeah. I'm on record for this, folks. If you go look at my campaign or my assertion of what a constitutional president, what we should be seeking in a president, the president should actually be leading the charge in getting and changing the whole enforcement of laws, that at the local level, you don't have police force. You don't have mercenary forces anymore, that every citizen has to be, you know, well adapted to what the laws are. You know, if you actually had the citizenry enforce the laws, a lot of laws would literally change. Like, you know, do we really need to go, you know, only 60 miles an hour on a stretch of freeway that, you know, could easily sustain 80, 90 miles an hour? Because the amount of traffic through the interstates in Nebraska and some of these, you know, states, are you kidding me? We're going to actually pull people over because they're going excessive because of posted speed. And when it comes down to enforcement and everything else, I think you kind of have to leave that to, you know, to the judgment. And actually, you throw the book at somebody if they have an accident, especially if they harm somebody. We have to actually start changing our paradigm. And, you know, what do we do? Well, you know, the whole point is, it for safety or is it for revenue? And 9 times out of 10, it's more for revenue than it is for safety.
Mm.
So when we really start looking at, you know, like running a red light, you know, there's, it's one thing to, you know, charge somebody for running a red light, you know, if you catch them. But, you know, if that person came up to the light, like at midnight, if I ran a red light, my ticket would be the same if it was midnight or if it was during rush hour traffic. And that's not right, because you could easily pull up to, you know, and look at an intersection and go, there's no cars coming. You know, there's not even lights. And you can make a safe, you know, crossing of that intersection, and you get that ticket, especially with the camera tickets today. It's about revenue. You can't convince me that there's any safety involved in this. But if somebody runs a red light and somebody has an accident, they have an accident, they cause an accident, then they should have greater liability for the damages occurred than just a ticket. And they do. That 9 times out of 10, the insurance company goes after you and you have the full liability. So why?
Sure, you caused harm.
You caused at least property damage, and that's all the insurance company cares about. But I'm just saying that we need to change our paradigms, because we have way too much of a mercenary state and a police state than we have a state of liberty. And, you know, we should actually, an enlightened society should be at a point where we don't even have laws. We observe conditions. We observe what is safe and what isn't safe. And if you're observing and you have an accident, and it comes out that, it's, you know, you were driving slow, you know, you, as a matter of fact, speed limits should be recommendations, you know, but not enforced. So that if you're traveling on the road and you're going less, you know, because of the conditions, you know, raining, what have you. And I'm diving into this way too far, but bottom line is that, you know, if you took extra precautions and you still got in an accident, I think that your liability should be lessened because you were at least cognitive of trying not to have an accident. And anyway, and your involvement in the accident or what have you should be cognizant. You know, there's some person that may be going way too slow and somebody's going the speed limit and it hits them. Well, that the person going way too slow is the cause. So, you know,
right.
This is where, folks, it's a time we actually started understanding self-governance and started having these deeper conversations. And I don't think it would take long to actually get people to start agreeing that we need to change our system radically. And it needs to be focused at the county level, which is why the first thing you need to be working on is a constitution for your county, where you want to actually establish what powers you want that local government to have. Because then you go to your state, that state should have less powers. And when you get to the federal government, it should be less.
Because it's interesting. that you say we need to change our system radically.
Yes.
The point is, it's already being radically changed.
Yeah, but it's being changed for the wrong reasons. It's being centralized at the World Banks. It's being centralized in global governance at the UN and so forth. And that never bodes well when you actually allow the centralized power to go from shifting from the county to the state to D.C., and now it's going into global governance. The World Health Organization is being given governing powers. This is all unconstitutional. This is why we do these petitions. But this is all about the Constitution today, and as we go through it in the next few days, well, several more days, because look, it's just one day getting through the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is so well misunderstood. I mean, there's so many people that look at this wrong on both sides. We have to understand. Now, there's purists within the Second Amendment movement that, you know, really absolutely, they completely agree because they really look at this. I mean, I think Stephen Holbrook wrote some really good books regarding Every Man Be Armed. And I think his perspective on this is really worth noting. And I think that there's lots of other people that understand the militia. And I think you know the guy in Virginia. You've mentioned him before. And, you know, me and names. I mean, shoot, I kept on switching Hawaii for Canada. So when we look at, you know, getting subject matter experts and their insights, because they've made a living, they've made a livelihood out of diving into this one particular topic. And I think that, you know, we would be fools not to really dive into the empirical data that these guys have uncovered. Right. So, I mean, the better informed we are, the better systems we create. The framers prove this, but actually, you know, it's not just having better information. It's having better information and seeking the divine hand of providence guidance in what to do moving forward. That's the other part of the solution. We absolutely need to, you know, humble ourselves and seek inspiration and guidance from the divine hand of providence so that we can radically move in the way that the our creator's design was meant for. There's no doubt in my mind that, you know, there was a purpose why we were supposed to be enforcing. It was a self-government system. And it makes more and more sense to me how, you know, how divine this Constitution really is. And it really does put the power in the hands of the people and their representatives. And the place that absolutely stands out more and more moves down to the county and then into your community. If you live in a populated area and your county is so well populated that you can't remember, I think we were just talking about this, maybe not. Weren't we just talking about representation and how the framers argued over that very first amendment that never got ratified?
Correct.
How the framers argued and argued what the true representation really meant. We ran out of time, so we'll need to cover this back up in our next episode. But, you know, if they argued over what the true representation should be and the max limitations, then, I mean, we're really missing the boat on the Second Amendment, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.